The Alaska Libertarian Party is incensed about the census. Party Chairman Bruce Boyd of Fairbanks explains why.
The Libertarians feel that a vast majority of the questions that are required on the census forms are unnecessary to government functions at any level, and they feel that they're a basic invasion of our civil liberties. We don't feel it's appropriate for government to be inquiring as to how many other languages you speak in your house, or how many births each individual female has had, if any have been stillborn, if you have any mental history or aberrations in your family, those kind of questions.
Do you have any objection to people filling out certain sections of the forms?
No, I don't have an objection to that. For example, I myself filled out that there were two males in my house and one female, and their ages, and that was it.
When the census taker came to collect the form, the long form in Boyd's case, she was not too pleased.
She tried, you know, to talk me into filling out the rest of it, and spent, I guess, oh, maybe 10 minutes. And left me some pamphlets and said her supervisor would come by. And he hasn't been by yet.
What do you intend to do when the supervisor does come by?
Same thing I did when she came by. Two males and a female and their ages.
Before Boyd was visited by the enumerator, I asked him if the possibility of legal action against him, of a fine of up to $500 for refusing to cooperate, was in any way a deterrent.
No, it doesn't bother me a bit. There's a penalty for a lot of things that government does that we feel are an invasion of our privacy. I think if you filled out the information about how many people and what ages and what sex are living at your house as the intent of the census was, I don't think you'd have a problem.
Boyd is probably right. According to Ruth Kitkin, who is supervising the census, few people have refused to cooperate, and the enumeration is going very well in Fairbanks.
Do you anticipate that there might be any cases where you do try and prosecute someone?
Not at this office, you know. Like in 1970, there was only 5 people that were brought to court, you know, mm-hmm. over the whole nation. I really don't think so.
If, however, people are brought to trial for refusing to cooperate with the 1980 census, 2 Fairbanks legislators have introduced a resolution calling on the governor to protect Alaskans' right to privacy, as guaranteed by the state constitution.
Brian Rogers, and co-sponsored by Libertarian Dick Randolph in the State House in Alaska, has got a resolution up that says the state should assist individuals in any defense that they need if they don't bother to fill out anything except for the pertinent information of who, how many, and how old.
To Boyd, this is the equivalent of establishing a defense fund if that's required due to massive civil disobedience.
In 80 million mailboxes across the USA,
the census is coming to help us find the way.
Help your community get equal government representation and help show where funds are needed for job programs, new schools, parks.
In your news release, you comment on truth in advertising laws.
Right.
That's one of your objections.
I thought that was kind of interesting. Well, the fact that one of the things that government hypes or pumps up is the fact that, you know, everybody benefits from filling out the census form and giving all the particular information that's required. And I find it hard to see the benefit that if it involves more federal programs or more money being dumped in a particular area, that's naturally going to affect our taxes.
Another truth in advertising conflict Boyd sees is the privacy provision. Much has been made of the confidentiality of the individual census forms.
One has to look at the fact that government can pass a law and change a statute very easily that opens up the information. Supposedly, the records are supposed to be destroyed after 40 years, and government's not, in fact, destroying them. The censuses since 1900 have been microfilmed, and they're kept on hand in a little place in Kansas.
You can count on me.
Can we count on you?
You can count on me.
According to Bruce Boyd, chairman of the Alaska Libertarian Party, some things about the census are unaccountable. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks. The major ceremonial activity for the Nulato Cayucan Indians is the Feast for the Dead, referred to as the Stick Dance or Hiyo, after the spruce pole that dominates the action on the fifth of the 7 days of activity. Only two Yukon River villages hold this midwinter celebration, Kaltag and Nulato, who may alternate from year to year. There's at least a year of preparation for the event, particularly for those who are commemorating the death of a loved one, whether recent or many years past, and for the people who will be dressed, who represent the deceased. The week of stick dance is an emotional time for all, as the spirits of the dead are laid to rest. The story of the origin of the Feast for the Dead derives from a dream that a man had long ago. Dorothy Summer, who will this year be commemorating or dressing for the death of one of her sons, tells the story of the beginning of the stick dance, recorded in 1974.
He lost all his people, everybody that was related to him. And one night, in his sorrow, he had this dream explaining everything about the plate that goes back and forth and everything that went with the stick dance. So he held a meeting and he told the people about his dream and the way things went in his dream. So the people said they didn't understand, they never heard of it, they never saw it. So he said, well, okay, why don't we just do as I say, and if everybody agrees with what I say and go along with me, then we'll find out what the real thing is all about. He said he really didn't understand it himself, but if they went through with what he had dreamt, well, things were going to turn out like his dream, or at least he hoped it had turned out like his dream. So they did. And when they went through with the whole thing, it turned out so well that they said, from now on, we'll never put that down. We're going to just keep it up. And so this is what the stick dance is today.
The dish going back and forth that Summers refers to is special food, food that the dead person enjoyed in life, that is given to the person or people who will be dressed for them. The dish is usually a dishpan filled with dried fish, fruits, candy, sometimes a can of beer and other items covered with a cloth. The person receiving the dish then reciprocates, returning the pan with other food. During the year preceding the stick dance, this activity is sporadic, but for the actual week of the ceremony, dishes may be exchanged several times a day. Dressing means just that. A person who is close to the dead person or helped prepare the body in some way receives clothing like that of the deceased. All new clothing, much of it handmade, from underwear through parkas and boots. The ceremony of the dressing occurs on the sixth night of the seventh and is seen as the culmination of the event, as the last time people will see the dead person is represented by the one or more people who have been dressed in their honor. There is a fixed sequence to the week's activities. During the day, women bead and sew the clothing and gifts that will be distributed on that sixth night, the dressing, and cook and bake for the special dishes and the nightly potlatch. There must be enough food for the 300 villagers plus what may be an equivalent number of visitors. The type of potlatch varies from evening to evening. Monday night, the first of the nights of the festival, there is a full potlatch: beaver meat, moose stew, duck soup for the old folks, king salmon strips, dried fish, pilot crackers, tea, and desserts. A full meal plus extra to take home for later. Then the next night, the potlatch is of dried fish, tea, and desserts, followed on Wednesday again by a full meal, Thursday desserts. Friday the night, the spruce pole, the stick, is brought into the community hall, a full potlatch again, and so on. As people enter the hall, they put the food they have brought near the front, along with the special dishes. Later, after speeches and a blessing, everyone eats. The expense and time is considerable, especially for people who are commemorating loved ones. In the old days, preparing for stick dance, called hiyo, was much harder than it is now.
They had to trap and make that money. And everything they did and put into the stick dance was what they got by their own hands and their own work. You know,
like the tanning of the moose hides and everything. Just everything.
Nothing bought. Just everything is just made and homemade.
After the evening's potlatch, morning songs are sung, some of them new ones, others from years past. They are unaccompanied songs that recount in Kayakon Athabascan events from the lives and personality descriptions of the dead person. While the singing goes on, women in a semicircle holding scarves between their hands sway from side to side, their hands alternating front to back with the scarf, doing what's called washtub dancing. For four nights, morning songs are sung and washtub dancing occurs. The fifth night, Friday, is the actual stick dance, or hiyo, for which the week-long ceremony is named. During the day, the people who are to be dressed locate and strip all but the top boughs from a straight spruce tree, high enough to graze the top of the community hall, site of all the activities. Bright ribbons are wrapped around the trunk. After the evening's potlatch, the stick is brought in the hall to much excitement, and wolf and wolverine skins are tied near the top. It is, some say, the lifeline to the souls of the dead, the souls that are symbolically fed from the special dishes that will be symbolically given new clothes Saturday night, the souls of the dead that will be finally laid to rest through the stick dance. All of the evening, through the next morning, people will dance and sing around the pole. Jesuit priests who came to Nulato suppressed the activity for a time, labeling it pagan and superstitious. Recent priests have been more tolerant, and with the exception of accommodations for Easter and Lent, stick dance is not suppressed to accommodate the church. Polding Carlo, who several years ago dressed for the death of a son, recounts the conflict between Catholic Church and community beliefs in a 1974 interview.
We used to be so afraid to knowing that the priests were telling us that it's such a big thing against our religion that we were adoring the stick instead of God and this and that, that we wanted to and still do. You had to do it in a sneaky way, which again at the end didn't prove anything because from their viewpoint, it was still wrong. We still took part in something that was really bad, you know.
Now, without that fear, the feeling for stick dance and what it means for the people of the two villages that celebrate it is strong. Dorothy Summer.
We kind of understand most of it, but it's something that you really can't explain either. You know, it's in you, but you can't. You feel it and you know it, and you can't give it on to another person like our grandma did to me, you know. She'd say, I know you're not listening. I know you don't believe me. Everything is superstition for you. You're standing there. I'm talking. I'm wasting my time. I'm doing everything. You're not listening to me. Well, that's okay. That's your way. She said, if that's the way you want to be, well, I can't help you on that. But anyway, I'm talking and making myself feel better because I'm talking. So that's the way it went. I guess at the time I must have took something in because right now it sort of, comes back up in my mind and stuff there.
Dorothy Summer's grandmother died in 1953, but the tradition of stick dance lives on through the granddaughter and others like her who value the ceremony and the feelings of hiyo, the feast for the dead. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.